A week ago, Kony 2012, a half-hour video about the fugitive Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony, was viewed roughly 80 million times in 5 days, breaking the YouTube record set by Britain's Got Talent contestant Susan Boyle. It was produced by the charity Invisible Children and made by co-founder and filmmaker Jason Russell after a chance meeting with one of Kony's child soldiers who saw his brother's throat cut for trying to escape.
He told me more about his brother and what he would say to him if he were still alive.
I love you, but now I miss you. We are not going to meet, but we may meet in heaven, you see. Because if I saw my brother once again, I don't.
It's okay. Jacob, it's okay.
Everything in my heart told me to do something. And so I made him a promise.
And we are also going to do everything that we can to stop them. Do you hear my words? We're going to stop them.
The film immediately sparked a backlash from critics who challenged everything from Invisible Children's governance to its tactics to its portrayal of a complex situation, one that's greatly changed in the years it took to produce the film. The charity quickly opened its books and repeatedly explained its intention to create a tipping point for action. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has spent much of his life exposing human rights abuses and pondering what inspires empathy and action. He's seen how putting the focus on a single figure works.
For example, when the anti-apartheid movement was trying to figure out how to galvanize the public for a long time, they had an effort to free South African political prisoners, and it got nowhere. And then they changed the slogan to Free Mandela, and that took off. And likewise, I think the converse is what we're seeing right now. This Invisible Children video, it's a reminder that there really is an appetite out there if we can figure out how to target it.
So what did they figure out?
Well, one thing that we know intellectually is that it helps to have a bridge character, that Americans don't just want to focus on somebody abroad. And if there's an American who makes the journey to some distant place, or if that person abroad has relatives here, or there's some link, then people are more likely to watch a video or read about it. And they did that with the filmmaker himself and his son and their interest in something a long way away. And if they're interested, then maybe you should be too.
I know Hollywood has taken a lot of hits when dealing with the issue of civil rights in America or humanitarian subjects abroad, and they put an attractive, generally white person in the pivotal role. This is precisely what gets up some of the critics of Invisible Children's nose, the fact that the Ugandans aren't really telling their own story.
If we had people from Uganda, Central African Republic, and Congo telling the story without a bridge character, there would be less impact. If you have an American bridge character, it has more impact. And there's a real trade-off there. It's a little bit less authentic, and there's a trade-off between complexity and simplification.
To what do you attribute the backlash, especially by charities and NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the area that would presumably want the same outcome, Kony behind bars?
Nobody fights more viciously than humanitarians on whatever issue, whether it's microfinance or aid strategies. And it tends to be targeted often at those who are perceived as more aggressive in marketing in ways that make things less complicated. And that's exactly what Invisible Children has done. It's been just a mind-boggling success in marketing with a very simple narrative. And so I think it hits a lot of those buttons.
The backlash has involved not just marketing and oversimplification, but the policies promoted by the film, the presentation of the struggle itself.
The video should have made more clear that the problem used to be in northern Uganda, but that now the problem is Central African Republic, Congo, and to some extent South Sudan. You know, beyond that, I think the critics have been profoundly unfair. You know, I see three people who had voted 9 years of their lives to try to make a difference a long way from home, And it's unclear whether they will make that difference, but I think they're trying in reasonable ways, and I think that is something to be emulated, not scorned.
You're familiar with the Nigerian writer Teju Cole, right?
Sure.
He's been in the forefront of critics who feel that this whole approach is deeply condescending. He even singled out you in one tweet. He said, from Sachs to Christoph to Invisible Children to TED, the fastest growth industry in the U.S. is the white savior industrial complex.
Yeah, there's been a real discomfort and backlash among middle class educated Africans, Ugandans in particular in this case, but people more broadly, about having Africa as they see it defined by a warlord who does particularly brutal things, and about the perception that Americans are going to ride in on a white horse and resolve it. To me, though, it seems even more uncomfortable to think that we as white Americans should not intervene in a humanitarian disaster because the victims are of a different skin color.
Do you believe that the positive attention that the film has gotten is part of the white savior industrial complex?
There's no doubt that it is kind of cool for young Americans to worry about problems halfway around the world and sometimes to worry more about problems in Malawi than in Newark. On the other hand, I think it is really commendable that a lot of young Americans find that their empathy doesn't stop at the border. And I don't think they should apologize for the fact that they have compassion for families who are being killed and raped and mutilated in the Central African Republic. And just as it was a mistake for us not to intervene early in Bosnia, for example, or in Rwanda, because the issues were seen as complex and distant and remote, I think it's a mistake to turn aside from villagers in Central African Republic and Congo, who I might say are desperate for help from anybody who can possibly provide it.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.